Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Award-winning journalist Ann Curry has dedicated her career to telling the stories of others, often covering the most devastating humanitarian crises and conflicts of our time, Syria, Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Darfur. In her new PBS series, We'll Meet Again, which is now in its second season, Ann takes a closer look at the significant historic events that have shaped America and the United States and its citizens, but not just from the point of view of prominent figures, but through the experiences of individuals who experience these occasions. The last episode of season two, The Fight for Women's Rights, airs tonight on PBS. And it is so good to see you.
I am absolutely delighted to see you,
Allison. I haven't
seen
you since our NBC days. Go way back machine. These are Journalism 101 questions, which you'll appreciate, so I'm going to ask them.
Sure.
What drew you to this project, and where did the idea for the series come from?
Sure. The idea originally came from my co-executive producer. Her name is Justine Kershaw. She lives in Britain, and she had an experience, a personal experience, in which she sort of fell off a mountain on vacation and was found by local people who rescued her. I mean, she was quite broken up, and she was rescued. And then finally, you know, she had much surgery, went on to have her life, had children, got married, had children, and then decided to take her children back to see this place where her life had changed. And what she was so surprised to discover was that not only did it mean something to her, it meant something to the people who had rescued her. I mean, they broke up, the two shepherds who found her. It was in Europe. She, you know, started sobbing. So she's realized that there's something about connection, something about even connecting people who don't know each other very well when something happens. So what happened is that I got the idea over the phone from her, and I knew immediately. It resonated immediately because I've spent, as you just mentioned, a career talking to people, as you have, you know, right after some great, terrible thing has happened. And I'm talking about, in our series, about wars and humanitarian disasters and huge movements that changed people's lives and the everyday people who were caught up in them. I knew immediately, having had to be the person who asks the questions right after something terrible happens, a tsunami, something, that there would be something poignant and rich about asking people questions after they've had time to process. Mm-hmm. And then the idea that, because I've seen this idea of rescue, right? The idea that some person can help rescue emotionally or physically in these events, the idea of reconnecting those people, I knew immediately that this had power. So that's why I said yes.
It's interesting when you think about, you've seen the photos of the firefighter and the child, and immediately see that photo, and you know there's a whole story there. You know they have individual stories, and then they have the story of their coming together. So it seems like a perfect, if it seems a perfect for you, and for PBS, because it's an opportunity, I'll give public media a shout out, to let things unfold. I'd love to know a little bit more about the process of making the show, finding the people, and then also, you know, producing that 54 minutes of television.
Right. It's been the episode that airs tonight is our 12th 1 hour, 55 minute piece of work. And, you know, it's a, you know, we've looked at tonight's episode is about the women's movement, but you know, when you go back, you sort of figure out, well, okay, what were the big moments for Americans, and that may mean events happening overseas, you know, World War II. It may mean events happening here, you know, the gay rights movement in this country. And then what we do is we go, okay, how do we then track down some people who experience this firsthand from the, you know, being on the front lines, people who others may know nothing about. These are people who have not told their stories, and as you well know, those who have not told their stories, those who are least heard, often have the most fascinating stories, right?
Yeah.
And so to track them down, I mean, a lot of it, the work is online. It's sort of looking at organizations that people join, you know, sort of basically backtracking through that. Sometimes, for example, one of our episodes was about a boy who had escaped Berlin after Kristallnacht, to go to Shanghai because it was one of the few places that was accepting Jews who didn't have because it was a place you didn't need to have a passport, and Hitler had mm-hmm. Forced Jews to have the letter J stamped on their passports, which meant that we're stateless. So there were organizations for Jewish refugees from World War II. In Shanghai. So you go through the organization and then you sort of find somebody who, and then you start asking questions, well, is there somebody you'd like to find? So there's a lot of that kind. The research part is the most time consuming. And we have a great team and really just highly motivated, a lot of them quite young in their 20s, just highly motivated to sort of make a difference in these people's lives by sort of telling their stories if they want them told, and also to take care of them. I mean, when you ask someone who, in some cases, is in his or her 70s or 80s to reflect on one of the most traumatic moments of their lives, you know, you sort of, there's a lot of sensitivity that you need to be involved in.
A lot of care.
Yeah, a lot of, and aftercare. And mm-hmm. and we have actually received letters back from some of these people. One of our episodes this season was about Cuban refugees who escaped Cuba, just to sort of connect to your last episode segment. And you know, it's just been remarkable, the impact on their lives, because it just keeps going. These relationships sometimes keeps going.
One of the things you said, so it's rang with me. When you interview somebody who's been quiet or maybe a little bit of reticent, and they'll say, oh, honey, I have nothing to tell you. Mm. And then 2 hours later, you can't believe the story that this person has just told you. It's amazing. Tell me a little bit about some of your skills as a journalist that you use to help those people tell their stories.
Well, you know, I think it's the skills that you have, Allison. I mean, it's really about listening, isn't it? And sort of listening for those things that help a story unfold. I think that, to your point, people don't realize that they have such a great story because they're not listened to. But when you listen, really, really listen to people, they click in and they know they have something to say. And it's really about really showing the respect of listening. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we haven't actually had trouble documenting these stories. Once we find them, we haven't had problems documenting, although sometimes we don't know where they will lead. In one of our episodes, it was about a young Amerasian girl who was left in Vietnam. Her father was an American who left, and her mother was a Vietnamese woman who's now trying to track down her father. And she tracked him down and realized that she had come too late and he had already died. But that he had left something that let her know that she was loved. And that's something that she would not have found had it not been for our and her pursuing with courage this story, this connection. And I think that's it. You know, what I've learned from this is that every single one of us, whether we have been in a war, humanitarian disaster, or movement, every single one of us has someone we want to thank, to reach back out to and say, wow, you know, you may not know, but you said this to me and that changed my life. And I hope if you take anything from what I'm saying, it's to not waste time and not try to be on time to reach back to that person. And because it's just an enriching experience, not just for them, but for you.
We're speaking with Ann Curry about her show, We'll Meet Again, second season on PBS. The final episode will air tonight. I'm curious. I want to talk about the episode, but I'm listening. who's someone that you think about who made a difference along the way?
Well, I actually took my own advice and tried to find her. She was a teacher when I was in high school, who insisted that I apply for college. It's sort of, people may not know this, but I come from a family in which there was no one who had ever graduated from college in my family.
Big family, five kids?
Five kids. And my father decided to go to college on the GI Bill. And so the idea was sort of in my mind to think about for the first time when I was actually in high school, never thought about it before as being even possible. And there was no money in our family. My mother was the daughter of a rice farmer, from the mountainous regions of Japan. My father was, from a long line of, of poor people who came to this country in the 1600s and fought in the Revolutionary War, and many of them, and fought in the Civil War and fought in wars. They were basically military people and railroad builders and people like that. No one had gone to college except my dad. So this woman insisted upon seeing my grades and thinking something of me, and she marched me down to the school office to apply. And I applied to one college because I had run out of time to apply to anyone else, to any others. And I was accepted. And it changed the course of my life. And I did go searching for her. And I found out that it was too late in finding her. I learned a little bit more about her life. And one thing I still have to do is I'd love to find out if I can find her children or her grandchildren. She was my English teacher at Ashland Senior High. So if you know something, Mrs. White. But I did go by too late. And I know it would have meant something for her. So I would recommend
doing it.
You do it, Allison.
Money on it, though. She would sit and point at you on the Today Show and say, "I know that young woman. I knew that young woman had promise." So I'm sure she got great joy out of that.
I hope so.
Tonight's episode is great for a couple of reasons. It's the fight for women's rights, and it really gives a sense of how recent there was just like horrible, horrible sexism, raging sexism, not that long ago.
1970s.
Even the woman with the sit-in was early 80s, right? Mm-hmm. So there are two stories. The first one is about two women who both fell in love with aviation, mm-hmm. but did not want to be flight attendants. Mm-hmm. They wanted to fly. Lynn Rippelmeyer. Tell us a little bit about Lynn.
Lynn was able to go to college at a time not long after the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which, as you know, said that places of work should be open to people regardless of their sex or their race. And she, as a result, when she went to college, she thought maybe she didn't want to be what every other young woman who had gone to college had as an option, be a teacher, a secretary. I think there may have been one other option for them, but not very many options. And a nurse, I think that was the other option. She wanted to be something else. She wanted to be a pilot. And when she finally at some point applied to the airline, she actually did become a stewardess. And so, what was really remarkable and it was the discovery of all this footage released by the airlines that showed stewardess in hot pants and really highlighting their sex appeal and having them walk strutting really into these ads for the airlines. She had to become, that was the only option open to her. But nevertheless, the 1964 Civil Rights Act allowed women to start moving into the workplace in a way that made what happened in the 40s during the war pale by comparison. Women had an opportunity, but they had to make their own way. And that's what Lynn had to do. And she eventually, because of the Civil Rights Act and because of the Anti-Discrimination Act and because of a lot of other things that happened, she suddenly, a small airline had to hire a woman as a pilot. But they wouldn't let them work under certain conditions. They had to only work under these conditions. They had to have another man in the cockpit because there was this idea that you needed a man to pull the plane up as you were taking off, that it needed the strength of a man to do that, which I think there might have been a slight argument that it took a little extra strength, especially in the older planes, but actually it was overstated. And Lynn was seeking a woman named Emily Jones, who witnessed what became a pilot ahead of her, became a captain ahead of her, and she thought she saw in front of her an example of what she could be, and she found a way to learn to be a pilot, and she became the first woman to captain a 747 across the Atlantic. this woman, Lynn Riplemeyer, was a groundbreaker, now seeking, telling us that she was seeking, hoping to find this woman who showed her it was possible. And it's just so wonderful to see, to go back and to interview her, number one. She's a wonderful woman. But then to see that comparison, that video of what she had to be, and then the fine footage and still pictures of what she became, and which was a woman who made her dream come true, broke ground for other women still to come, who should be remembered in aviation history, and I think will be, for what she's done. And there was another woman we profiled for this episode. Her name is Zoe Nicholson, and she fought for the Equal Rights Amendment.
We've got a caller who wants to chime in, somebody I haven't talked to in a while, but who I'm happy to hear from. Hi, this is Juliana Margulies, the actress.
Hi, Allison. Hi.
Hi, Juliana.
Hi, Juliana. How are
Hello.
You?
I know, this is so random, but Allison, I listen to your show every day.
Oh, sweetie, thank you so much.
And I'm sitting here listening, and you mentioned this Jewish refugee who found the only place to go was in Shanghai. And 2 years ago, I got sent a script to voice a documentary called Above the Drowning Sea about the Jews who fled to Shanghai because there was no passport control there. It was an open border because
That's
they
right.
couldn't. Anyway, it's a beautiful film. And I got sent the script from an old producer I had worked with on my first TV gig, Law and Order, which is what every actor does in New York City.
Right.
And he said, any chance you would want to do the voiceover for this? It's not, you know, not a lot of money, but it's $10,000. And I read the script on the train. I was going somewhere to do a job, and I immediately called him and I said, I'm not going to take money for this, but this is the most beautiful story I have ever heard, and I'm so glad someone's paying attention and telling these people stories. And please give whatever money you would have given me to the refugee crisis, and let's, you know, get this out in the world, because these stories, and when you watch the movie, it's so devastating and gorgeous how remembering, and you see these friends go back to each other.
That's right.
You know, to say thank you.
You know, I think that's really powerful. I'm so glad that you did that. Most people don't, you know, there are so many stories that are still untold from the Holocaust and from World War II, as many as have been told. But this is one that I think many people would be surprised to even know about. And you know, I actually was in Shanghai for other reasons, and I discovered that there had been a ghetto even before I did this piece, Juliana. And I actually found the place. I saw it where they had corralled people. What happened is that they went there and they were free to arrive, just as you said, because they, Shanghai was allowing stateless people in, and these were people who, who were affected by Kristallnacht, so they already knew that they had to get out, right? But the thing is, it wasn't until the Japanese came into Shanghai that they were corralled, and the place that they were crammed into,
yeah.
I mean, it was a true awful ghetto.
It was a ghetto. There were 12 people to a tiny room.
And they were not fed. They were children dying. It was just horrendous.
Yeah.
And so I'm really, and so there's a real story of survival. There's a story, and there's a and you know, you would be delighted probably to hear this, that some of the survivors of the Shanghai ghetto actually get together in Chinese restaurants to have reunions.
Oh, that's fantastic. I always wondered why me and my Jewish friends always ended up in a Chinese restaurant on Christmas night. That's where we eat.
I know, exactly. I mean, there actually is a reason but it's just a beautiful, beautiful part of the story, part of the survival. And there are so many who are not well known, who stepped up. And I think that's really the big story.
But that's the story.
Right. That people stepped up to save others because they knew something was was wrong. And you know, once, and I'm not name dropping here, but I am kind of, I was mentioning to Oprah how I wish I could do more sometimes about things that I thought were, that I wanted to do more to help the world. And she said, Anne, you know, all you can do is what you can do.
Right.
And that is what you should do. And that's what people did. They did what they could do. And
yeah.
that's what's really remarkable. You know, whether it's, I think his name is Shinue Sugawa, I may be mispronouncing his name. He was a Japanese man who worked in the, he was kind of the Raoul Wallenberg. He was the Raoul Wallenberg for Japan. And he basically, you know, gave people passports, entry. There were so many of these people.
That
and
was
I just,
the same at Kristallnacht. There was a Jewish ambassador, a Chinese ambassador to Austria.
Mm.
And he's the one who gave the passports.
Yeah, it's just...
And he changed so many people's lives, and he doesn't know.
That's
because
right.
he didn't know what happened to them once they went to Shanghai.
That's right.
And it was a brutal, brutal, taxing journey. And but that's the beauty of humanity. That's what I love about what I'm hearing, and I can't wait to see your show tonight, because in this time of division, there are these gorgeous glimpses of light of people who care and who make a difference. And just one, it's like the smile. You know, if you smile when you walk down the street, mm-hmm. the next person passing you, it's infectious. They're going to smile. And next thing you know, there's a block of people smiling, but no one knows why.
That's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. And I would take your statement and I would go just a smidge
further,
because I would say that it's especially in tough times
yes.
that people step up.
Yeah.
And I think that the other comment that you made, I would also want to support that if you can do these things without wanting something back, without needing to know what happened,
that's exactly
because
right.
it is the right thing to do the thing because it is the right thing to do.
Right.
That is the way of, I think, having power. And
absolutely. And that's the way of being on the right side of history.
That's right. Exactly.
And
right.
it's the silent doers. Not the one, it's the people who walk the walk and don't talk the talk that accomplish it.
Mm-hmm.
And it passes it forward to the next person, because one person does an act of kindness. It inspires the next person to do an act of kindness.
It is exactly how we're made, Julianne. You're absolutely right. It's how we're made. We
yeah.
are made for this. It is a part of what we know from science, a part of our foundational, it's in our code, our DNA, how we respond.
Yeah.
We can choose light or darkness. And
right.
when we have an opportunity, we want to choose light.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't want to take over your show. I just want
to. I've been delighted to talk to you. I hope you don't
well,
mind.
Julianne, I'm
yeah.
so excited to
Thank
hear
you
from
for
you.
Your thoughts. Thank you so much for calling
I'm
in.
I'm so grateful for the work both of you are doing. Truly.
Thank you.
We need more women like you out in the world.
And a big, big hug to Kieran.
Okay.
Thank you.
Take care.
How kind of her.
Our kids played together as babies. That's how
oh.
I know Julianne.
Oh, my
from,
goodness.
Like, the playground.
Gosh.
It's so funny that time flies. I have so much more I want to talk to you about.
Sure.
I want people to watch your show tonight, The Fight for Women's Rights. I do want to play one clip before we let you go about this woman, Zoe.
Oh.
This woman, Zoe, is involved in a sit-in. It's a hunger strike for women's rights, and she is highly inspired by someone, and this is the person that she wants to find. So let's roll this clip of Zoe, and then we can talk about it on the other side.
Okay. As the deadline approached, Zoe felt she had to take action. She spoke with Sonia, the one person who she knew would feel the same.
I said to her, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And I meant that most literally. I wasn't speaking metaphorically. I was saying, Sonia, what are you and I going to do? And she said the right thing. And I said, well, I don't care what it is. The answer will be yes. And she said, it's going to be a fast. I said, fine. Tell me where, tell me when, I will be there. She said, okay, good. I have others to call. And that was the end of that phone call.
It was a decision that would propel Zoe into the headlines, expose her to ridicule, and push her to the brink of death.
It's such an amazing story what these women went through.
That's right. They fasted for 36 days. It was in 1982, and 35 of the 38 states required to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment had done so, and they needed three more states to vote for it. And they risked their lives. I mean, they refused medical treatment, and they got very, very sick. One, it appeared that she, you know, was close to having heart failure. It was really, really bad. And they did not succeed. And it was devastating, devastating to everyone, of course, who had risked so much, but especially to this woman, Sonia Johnson, who was an activist who really believed that she couldn't live in a world in which there wasn't this idea in the Constitution that men and that it didn't matter what your gender was, that you were you had equal rights. That was her perception. And so she, after this, disappeared. Just no one could find her. And so young Zoe, the woman you heard, who was young at the time, who had risked her life agreeing with Sonia Johnson, you know, took us through this second wave. This was the second wave of the women's movement. And she wanted to find Sonia. So it took a lot. And and I think it speaks to what it can take, but it also can speak to where we are today. You know, the women's movement, there was the first wave that gave us the right to vote, this wave which helped give us opportunities, and now we're in the middle of the third wave. I'm not even the middle, I think the beginning of the third wave, which is the one that is aiming to give us, to help us reach our full potential as equal partners in the world and guiding the world and supporting the world. And so it's been interesting to see how some of these episodes have resonated in a relevancy today. It's been surprising in many ways, because I thought we were talking about history, but these stories come back again and again.
And to talk about how relevant is, last question, Susan Zirinsky was named the head of CBS News yesterday.
Isn't that something?
After they've had their difficulties, everywhere has had their difficulties. We don't need to rehash all of that. Do you think it makes a difference when we do have women put into these positions?
Absolutely. I think that when women are known to be prospects for the highest positions in the land, in corporate America or in politics, in government, they are treated differently as they're rising, aren't they? Their power is perceived to be different as they're rising. They are seen and treated in a more equal fashion. I think that when it is not believed that they will ever be in charge, when it is not believed that they can achieve greatness, it is much easier to look at them and treat them in a way that diminishes them and derails them. And I think, you know, Susan Zirinsky, who is clearly, if anyone has been overqualified for a job,
I know, right?
it's Susan Zirinsky. I mean, so she's overqualified for the job, but she's taking it. And, you know, I think that having her in that position and having women at least be seen as being possible in those positions will go a long way in changing, as I say, this final bit, that taking away these final hurdles that prevent women from achieving their highest potential. That is where we are. It's another, I think, symbol, the change in Congress, more women in Congress. We should celebrate it, but it's clearly not enough, but still we should celebrate it. Women rising in positions of power, people being held accountable. All of this is part of this third wave, and we'll see where it ends up.
The name of the show is We'll Meet Again. Season 2 is on PBS. The final episode is tonight. Tune in to your local station to find it. Ann Curry, such a pleasure to see you again.
I love talking to you, Allison, and to Juliana, too.
Coming up next, the film series at MoMA highlighting the works of Sidney Poitier. We'll talk to its curator after the break. This is All of It. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. With all the award show fervor over the next few months, let's take a few moments to honor those who have truly changed cinema and what we see on the big screen. Sidney Poitier, the name alone conjures images of grace and sincerity and dignity. He will go down in history as the first black man to win an Academy Award in 1964 for his performance in Lilies in the Field. He broke so much ground over the course of his long career. He's been recognized for his skill in as an actor, including in being the recipient of the 2009 Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Obama, as well as being a Knight Commander of the Order of the British Empire. For a deep dive into the career of Sidney Poitier, the Museum of Modern Art has a series called Modern Matinees, and it's kicking off 2019 with a program called Sir Sidney Poitier. Anne Moore, Associate Curator in the Department of Film at MoMA, organized the event. It's running through February 28th. Anne, thanks for coming to the studio.
Thank you so much for having me this afternoon.
So why did you decide to start with Sidney Poitier, focus the year on him?
Great question. I keep an informal running list of those subjects, directors, genres, movements that I'd like to make the focus of modern matinees. And Sidney was at the top of my list for many months now, and it was a matter of getting the prints and the films and the DCPs that I needed together. And also, I like to take a deep dive into the research, and I read both of his autobiographies and many of the scholarly articles that were out there and reviews of his films. And I wanted to understand him because I had always been a fan, but I had not put on my curator hat at that point. And so once I had my curator hat on, I was able to look at the films very differently and his performance and understand who this man was, starting in the earliest films and then coming to the later part of his career.
First of all, great job.
Thank you.
That you get to, I know, dig into Sidney Poitier. Vanity Fair described him as the last of an old Hollywood breed, the gentleman hero in the bespoke suit. What does that mean?
I think, number one, it means that he is an icon, a true classic, a Hollywood hero that is often bigger than the other characters in the film in terms of his own sense of self and worth and dignity. And God, he's so good to look at.
So handsome.
And he's commanding. And that is really how we think about the classic Hollywood actor and actress.
And I also think dignity is a really big part of it, because African-American men were not treated with dignity for so long. And here he comes and he is this presence.
So true. I mean, he springs forth as this presence who is just, to me, I read him as filled with human dignity. Every single role is dignified and careful and considerate. And he sometimes has things thrown at him that I think any one of us would have either collapsed from or reacted in such defensive, negative ways. There's always a breath. Mm-hmm. Watch Poitier. When something is coming at him that you know is going to be very negative, there's a pause. There's a breath. He may take his glasses off, clean his glasses, button or unbutton his jacket, because there's that, he's taking that breath to say, I know that I'm better than this. And I watched the film Pressure Point this morning. Something I do, I like to refresh my memory about certain films. And there's a moment where he's sparring with an inmate. He plays the psychiatrist in a prison. And the inmate is just horrible to him, just so racist and bigoted. And Poitier takes off his jacket. And by taking off his jacket, the inmate refers to him more as an equal, because with the jacket on, he was authority. Just this moment is brilliant. This acting choice is brilliant.
I was watching a little bit of No Way Out earlier this morning, and you think about when this was made, 1950s, mm-hmm. He's playing a doctor. He's got to engage with a racist robber, a racist criminal. Let's play a little bit of a scene from No Way Out. This is when they first bring in the prisoner, and he certainly suddenly realizes he's got a black doctor.
Mm-hmm. Shut up. You're talking to a doctor.
A doctor? Him?
Lie back and lie still. You're in my charge.
Who's your friends, Kowalski?
Public Enemies 1 and 2.
I'm Dr. Brooks.
Yeah, they said you'd be up. Your first time here, isn't it, Doc?
That's right. Have an empty room?
Number 5.
Number 5. All right, let's get them in there right away.
What, you want to be booking them first? I'd like to turn them over.
I think it's important to examine them first, him in particular.
Okay. I don't want him. I want a white doctor.
We'll turn the lights out and you won't know the difference.
Haven't I got any rights?
No!
Can you provide a little context of why that was such an important role?
Well, first of all, it's his first role. And to be given this incredibly important part of Dr. Brooks in a film that stars Richard Widmark, who was major A-list actor, and Poitier is put on very equal ground with him. And not only equal ground, but he is the central character, if you ask me. And from what I read, Widmark very much wanted him in that role. And, you know, he was an unknown quantity. He had just come from New York, the American Negro Theater. He had had sort of middling reviews in the roles that he had on Broadway, although I believe his innate talent was what the critics recognized. And this film just propelled him into the stratosphere of Hollywood, total acceptance, and acceptance by an extraordinarily wide audience. So this was a very, very canny move for him. But I don't think he saw it that way. I think he saw it was another opportunity to stretch as an actor because he had not made a film before.
We're speaking with Anne Moore. She's associate curator in the Department of Film at MoMA. She curated the Sir Sidney Poitier event, which is running through February 28th. You know, 1967 was the big year as an actor. But he also had a career as a director as well. When did he start directing?
He started directing in the 1980s, I believe. I don't have the exact date for you, but he directed 9 films. And what's unusual is that they're comedies.
They are funny. Some of them are. I can remember seeing, oh my gosh. Go ahead. Keep going.
Yeah, they're comedies. And, you know, Sir Poitier is not someone we think of as a comedic choice to direct Richard Pryor.
Stir Crazy, that's the
one. Stir Crazy, right, which, you know, we're going to show that. To direct Richard Pryor and Gene Wilder, and he does, and it is such a funny movie. He creates this buddy movie, and the two of them just play off each other in this very lighthearted way. It's like madcap antics, and I remember the first time seeing the film, I think when it was released, and I had to go back and see who directed that. Sidney Poitier. How did that happen? But again, this is incredible skill. That's what this man has brought to his career on so many levels.
Can you give people a taste of the kind of films they'll be able to see?
Sure. I tried to mix up as much as I could. Modern Matinees is sort of finite in that it's Wednesday, Thursday, Friday at 1:30 in the afternoon. So you're going to see some of the most iconic films of the 60s and 70s and 80s, like In the Heat of the Night, To Sir with Love, No Way Out, Pressure Point, Blackboard Jungle, The Defiant Ones, Raisin in the Sun. I mean, everyone is important. Everyone is a classic. And this is the thread that runs throughout his career.
Such a great idea. First, when I started looking at the list, I thought, oh my God, you have this oh my God moment. And then you realize he's 91.
That's right.
He's a gift.
He's a complete gift, and if you look at his filmography, he sort of stepped back from being an active actor. But we know that he continues his work as a humanitarian, a philanthropist, someone who really stands up for to right the wrongs in society. But again, in this dignified, elegant way. His voice is so commanding.
So great.
And you know, he went through a great transformation with his voice, because when he arrived in New York, he was told, you know, hey, buddy, we don't understand a word you're saying. He had a very heavy Bahamian accent. And he went ahead and he went to see voice coaches. And that had to be a pretty dear price to pay for someone who was washing dishes, didn't have a great education, but he wanted to improve himself as an actor. And just listen to that voice today. It is so important. It is reverential. It is beautiful.
The name of the series is Sir Sidney Poitier. It's part of the Modern Matinees. It is running now through February 28th. Anne Moore, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for curating this.
Thank you so much, and I hope you will come to see some of the films.
1:30, and when maybe on a Saturday.
Well, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, but...
when I take a day off, everybody, you know where I'll be.
Okay, give me a call.
Don't go away. I'll be right back after a quick break with a conversation and performance by folk trio Lula Wiles. Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. I wish you could have just seen what happened in this studio. We're going to put it on Instagram. There's a trio in here. Lula Wiles. They all met at band camp. Yeah. Issa Burke, Eleanor Buckland, and Molly Opsenswain. The rest is history. Let's take a quick listen to Lula Wiles. I'll explain what happened on the other side. Lula Wiles is set to release its sophomore album called What Will We Do? It's happening on January 25th is the release. Issa, Eleanor, and Molly, thank you so much for joining us in studio. You guys are the biggest troopers. We gave you about 90 seconds to get in here with a stand-up bass, an electric guitar,
An amp, multiple other instruments.
So good. So you guys really did meet at summer camp, right?
Yes.
It's true.
What's the story?
Yeah, so all three of us grew up in Maine, and all of us have at least one parent who's a musician, and my parents were both on staff at the Maine Fiddle Camp, which is a traditional music camp in Maine. Yeah, and Ellie and Molly actually grew up together in the same town, so they already knew each other before Fiddle Camp, but their music teacher would always bring a lot of his students to camp, and so that was where we all first met and started playing music together. Ellie and I were like fiddle pals for for many years.
Did it become clear what your sound was going to be once you guys got together? I sort of called it modern twang.
I don't think so, actually. I don't know. Since we were all fiddle friends. We obviously we're very influenced. Our sound is influenced by traditional music, but I feel like we're constantly figuring out what we sound like.
Yeah. I think that, you know, what we sounded like a year ago versus 2 years ago versus 3 years ago, it's very different. And that's one of the most exciting things about being in a band is, you know, and playing music and being creative is that we can evolve and change and, like, continue to develop our sound.
There was no electric guitar at Fiddle Camp.
Yeah. Yes, for sure.
And it's a style-looking electric guitar, by the way. So how does the songwriting process work when you have three ladies who you all can interchange instruments as well? How does that work out?
It's true. It's pretty different. On this new record, What Will We Do?, it was incredibly collaborative, but generally one of us will bring a song to the band that's either completed or almost completed or just like the spark of a song. And, you know, it depends. You know, some of these on this record are you know, solo songs, and then a bunch of them are also co-writes. And it's just really every individual song has a different process, which is vague, but exciting. But,
yeah, I mean, I always like to say that you never really learn how to write songs. You just learn how to write the song that you're writing.
Somebody needs to put that on a poster somewhere.
I know, right? I think I read it somewhere. I'm not going to credit myself with that thought, but I can't remember where it was from. But yeah, co-writing has been a newer thing for the band. And it was an interesting thing to go from, like, you know, having been friends for years and playing music together for years to then start writing together. It's kind of like, starting to date your friend. Like, it adds just like this new dimension to your relationship, and writing songs together can be like very intimate. And it's like, oh my God, like, this is like one of the most important people in my life. Like, what if they think my idea is dumb and they don't want to put it in the song?
But then, you know, these are my friends and they love me. Exactly. So they will love me and support me no matter what.
So yeah, that has been a really cool part of the process for this new record.
Can we get you to play something? Yes. Since you haul those things in here so fast.
Exactly. Let's do Love Gone Wrong first.
Yeah,
cool.
This is Lula Wiles.
Yeah, we can hear that. I'm going to adjust this microphone.
We're going to play our new single that you can listen to on Spotify and all the other streaming places already. And this is called Love Gone Wrong, and it's a song we co-wrote, or the first song we ever co-wrote, actually. And Issa's adjusting her pedals. It's going to be magic.
All right, let's do it.
You good?
Yeah.
Okay. One, two, three, four.
Lula Wiles. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. So, ladies, the show is technically over, but I want you to stay put because I want to do a two-part.
All
can
right.
you stick around and we can tape some more after the show's officially
great.
Over? Okay, thanks so much for listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. You were listening to Luluverse. We'll have more with them maybe tomorrow, maybe in the week. We'll see you next time.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.